Hello and welcome to episode 40 of The Dive Down, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the casual spike focused on the latest decks, trends, and strategies in Modern. My name is Stanislav here in Chicago, and with me on the line from Denver, Colorado, it's the Summer of Veil, Shane Beeps.
That can't be right.
Well, don't you mean the Veil of Summer? By the way, how stupid was I to look at that card and be like, yeah, this is a great card, and then not buy any, and now it's like $250.
How stupid were you?
Very.
Also with us here in Chicago, it's our fry guy, Zach Culhan.
Should be noted, I'm fried in vegetable oil for all vegetarian fans out there.
Our Godfather Dave is out this week, but we'll be back next Friday. On this week's show, we break down the results from GP Ghent. Then we'll dive into everyone's favorite 15-card combo, Sideboard. We'll share some of our tips and thoughts on building your own sideboards, classic sideboarding decisions from common matchups, and attempt to hunt down the elusive transformative sideboard people keep joking about. But first, some housekeeping. Thank you to Jack J for joining our Patreon, and also special thanks to Brendan C and Alex W for the very nice reviews posted to Apple Podcasts. We're really glad to hear how much you like the show.
So we haven't really talked about the Patreon in a while, and I'd like to just remind everyone and newer listeners especially what it's all about. So what Patreon allows you to do as a listener is give some of your hard-earned money to us, the Dive Down Podcast, just because you like what we're doing. So when you join the Dive Down Nation, you get some awesome benefits. You get things like access to the super secret Slack channel, where we have awesome conversations every day with listeners. You get signed Dive Down cards. You get pins, stickers, custom tokens that were illustrated by a professional comic book artist. We even have our own custom playmat that Dave, who is a professional graphic designer, designed. And when we reach our next big stretch goal, we're going to be having custom deck boxes and sleeves made. But beyond all that sweet stuff, what you really get to do is help keep the Dive Down going. So you help pay for our editor, our hosting, the artists that we pay, all the swag that gets made. We honestly could not make this podcast without you. And so if you haven't yet, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thedivedown and join the nation. And even if you don't feel you can afford to join the Patreon, that's totally okay. Our content is always completely free. We don't have anything hidden behind a paywall. But you can even help us by telling a friend to listen to us, write a text review on Apple Podcasts, or even just give us 5 stars if you think we deserve that. But thanks for listening. We appreciate every one of you.
Yeah, and if you want to see some of these designs for our sleeves, tokens, and playmats, you can see all that on our Patreon. We post all that stuff for people to vote on, so we get, you know, our listeners say in the stuff that we create for them.
Where could they find that Patreon again?
It's over at patreon.com/thedivedown, which is the name of our podcast.
That's a good URL.
So moving on to the breakdown this week, we had GP Ghent. So first of all, we learned where Ghent is, and it's northwest of Brussels, but I can't imagine that Ghent likes being referred to that way. But this is over in Belgium, and it had 1,440 players across 480 teams enter. So that's a pretty sizable event. And this was Team Modern, which we've talked about in the past. So we talked about this for a GP Indianapolis, which, as we all know, is the Motor City. So Team Modern means 3 people bring whatever decks they want. There's different formats where you can only have a playset of non-basic lands, et cetera, et cetera. But in general, you're bringing 3 decks into a meta that you're trying to beat. And whichever team wins 2 out of the 3 matches gets the round win. So essentially, it could be where one person brings their deck and doesn't win any single game and could still potentially win the event, although that's more rare.
Yeah, and so that can make analyzing stats a little bit more challenging. But, you know, it's still awesome to get all this data. The Channel Fireballs provided for us again. They gave us a really big information dump to work with, and for that, we're truly appreciative. I'm going to walk us through some of this data that CFB provided to us. So first, we have the day one meta, the complete day one meta. It's super awesome to be getting this consistently from CFB. It gives us a really good insight into, one, what people are bringing to the tournament on the whole, and two, gives us conversion rates for day two, which we'll talk about in the near future. So
my understanding that there's a lot of wildfires happening, a lot of burn happening.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we did see 10.7% of burn, which is the most represented deck there. But this really shows us kind of the wide metagame that Modern can support when there isn't really a clear best deck. So we saw 12 deck archetypes arrive with over 3% representation. So I mentioned Burn, but we've got Tron at about 9, Jund at about 9, Wurza at about 8, Titan Shift and Eldrazi Tron about 4.5, Blue-White Stoneblade at 4.1, Grixis Shadow at 4, Blue-White Control, if you want to separate that from the Stoneblade strategies, at 3.5, Dredge at 3.3, Humans at 3.2, and Hardened Scales at 3. So that's everything that's over 3%. So pretty awesome.
So I have a quick question for everybody. We only see one Stoneforge deck in name in this top. Do you think that was people hedging their bets and not wanting to go in with a deck that was newer? Or do you think that Stoneforge isn't really as ubiquitous as it seemed in its early days?
So in terms of the ubiquity of the early days, are you referring to that like first 5-0 dump where it was in 22 different types of decks?
Well, I mean, the early days are at this point, what, 14 of them? So
yeah. So although you are right that, you know, in the decks we mentioned, it looks like there's only one clear Stoneblade deck. Once you start going down the list, like Jeskai Stoneblade is at 2%, and Devoted Vizier could be running it as well. You know, some of these decks might have it and it just not be in the nomenclature.
And other is a really big category, right? It's 23.8% of the meta. So that's every deck with less than 1% representation. You know, that's a really big portion. That's more than we've typically been seeing. Some interesting stuff I saw as one ofs because they gave us literally every deck in the tournament. I saw Tooth and Nail, Mono Green Stompy, a Singleton Obzon Midrange. Man, that is hilariously sad at this point because it was, you know, back in Pro Tour around Khans of Tarkir. It was a modern Pro Tour.
You mean 20 Obzon. Years ago?
Yeah, basically. But we did, of course, see both Red-Black Elementals and Scred Red.
This Scred Red deck is absolutely wild. Absolutely wild. It's running 4 of the Red Force main board, which I don't think is modern playable at all. But they were doing it, and there's been a lot of discussion about it in the Scred community, the Scrimunity, if you will. And it's neat. The European meta is different, as we've talked about several times, but just a neat deck choice with a neat 4 of choice.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that both Scred being in day one, having cool choices, but also the fact that we can see the deck list because CFB is giving us so much data. You can dig to your heart's content. You can see what, you know, all you Tooth and Nail fans out there can go and click that list and see what, you know, other Tooth and Nail players are bringing to the table. So moving on to day two, we saw a really similar metagame percentage to day one. Few of the most popular decks did anything abnormal in their day one to day two conversion rates. Every deck we just read that had over 3% meta representation still had over 3% meta share on day two. Besides Blue-White Control, that dropped to 2.4%. And Infect rose from 1.3% to 3% of the day two meta. In fact, Infect, Dredge, and Bogles were the three day one decks that had conversion rates of over 20%. Bogles had 11 pilots day one, and put 4 of those pilots into day two with that's a 36.4% conversion rate. You know, it's a pretty small sample size, but, you know, good on them. So we'll move on to the top four because these are team tournaments. They cut to a top four, and we'll go over those decks in a little bit more detail. First seeds after Swiss were Dominic Gertsen and Julian Plaga on Tron and Nicholas Laban on Esper, Stoneforge, Wurza. So the Tron lists featured the same 60 and had really, really small differences in the sideboard. They went for a pretty small Karn the Great Creator package of about 6 cards, which left them more room for important sideboard cards like Thragtusk, Spatial Contortion, Nature's Claim, and Veil of Summer.
I want to make a comment on their small Karn package, and I think that that's the way I feel. Personally, a lot of Karn decks are beginning to shake out, where they're going smaller on the package just because it is such a cost for your sideboard, which happens to be the topic of today's episode. But I think it is a real cost you have to pay. And as someone who's been jamming a ton of Karn decks, there are plenty of times where I go, okay, I'm taking out 5 cards and I'm only bringing in 3. Oh, no, that's not right. And it is a real deck cost. So I think going forward, I do predict we will see smaller, you know, honestly, 6-card Karn sideboards.
Yeah, it makes sense for sure. Because Tron really has to support, you know, a lot of life gain with their Thragtusks. They have to support small creature removal with the Spatial Contortion. They always have to have those Nature's Claims, and Veil of Summer is proving to be a truly important sideboard card for the strategy. So I think it makes sense. I thought this Esper Stoneforge Wurza deck was pretty novel. It basically was like a blue-white list that stretched a little bit into black for a main deck Thoughtseize, I think a few of them, and some sideboard Collective Brutalities, Dead of Winter, and Fatal Push. So not going full four color, but just kind of stretching a little bit to allow them to run some hand disruption, I thought was smart. Next up, we had our second seeds, Brent Voss on Jeskai Stoneblade, Niels Vondesand on Grixis Wurza, and Jesper Box on Neonate Dredge.
I love that name, Jesper Box. It almost sounds like a deck name in and of itself.
Oh, man, four-color Jesper Box again?
If MTG Goldfish has a little mess up on their metadata again, you might see it called Jesper Box. Jeskai Stoneblade, we might have to give up calling it Tempo Forge, guys. I think that Stoneblade is kind of taking over.
Never!
It was really similar to the ones that we've been seeing pop up, but a little bit more controlling. It had four Oft, two Jason Mind Sculptor, two Mana Leak, and two Spell Snare. So it was kind of eschewed the more tempo-y counter spells of like Spell Pierce, and didn't have any Giver of Runes at all, and also had no Celestial Colonnades. So it appears that he ran a singleton Blink Moth Nexus, which I guess would provide a cheap to activate flying finisher in the creature land, especially if you can slap a sword on it. That's kind of like my thought process about it. I can't imagine it being like a metadata issue, like in the deck reg. I think that's probably what it must have been.
If you're trying to play a more controlling game, I'm a little bit confused about the removal of Colonnade. I can see that in obviously more of a tempo-based build or coming in to play tapped as a real cost, but I feel like Colonnade is such a house. Is it just that the swords are too hard to equip to it when you activate it?
Yeah, I think it's just like kind of the mana sink element. Like you really have to have a lot of lands to activate your Colonnade, but you don't have to for your Blinkmoth Nexus. And so you can activate it, put a sword on it, get that flying damage in the end, especially if it has color protection. So next up, we had our third seeds of Laurent Sestaro on Burn, Jeremy Dazani, it's a name many of us will know, on Mardu Shadow, and Nicholas Shabriak on Bant Stoneblade. So this Burn deck was a little bit tweaked. It had a main deck Deflecting Palm, which I can't remember ever seeing. Skullcrack replaced the Helix, and also one replaced a Skewer the Critics. Sideboard had a full set of Paths and also a whole lot of Artifact Hate. It had a Stony Silence, two Smash to Smithereens, and two Shattering Sprees to really clean up the metal annoyances he expected to face.
the metallic thorns in his side, so to speak.
And then finally, we have our four seeds of Ruben Perez, Joel Calafell, they were both on four-color Wurza, and Esther Trujillo on Jund. The four-color Wurza decks had a few novel inclusions with a few Pentad Prisms and some sideboard Monastery Mentors, which I haven't seen as typical inclusions as of yet.
One of the things that I found playing against Wurza is that there are some really powerful sideboard cards that can shut that strategy down. One that I've mentioned a couple times is Rest in Peace coupled with Stony Silence is almost a lock against that deck, if not entirely. And I think being able to play Monastery Mentor is a nice way to have just a whole other threat so that you can potentially still win games even if your opponent is attacking your graveyard and your artifact.
For sure. Yeah, if you just cast your cheap artifacts, you're going to get some tokens. And Trujillo's Jund deck didn't seem to have anything off the wall, but their sideboard had some interesting selections. They had a couple Ashiok Dream Renders and also a Singleton Frasca Golgari Queen, which isn't completely novel, but...
Yeah, when we played Jund for our episode way back when, I had a Frasca Golgari Queen in my board, and I really liked it. I found that it sometimes, you know, obviously you want some action off the top, and she can be a little slow, but when the game gets grindy, she will always give you enough value, in my experience, to push past it. So if you're expecting a lot of mid-range mirrors or a lot of turns to go land, pass, she's going to be what gets you through that in the end.
And Vraska Golgari Queen, not exactly a modern staple. I kind of want to read it out loud because I had to look it up myself. It's 2BG for a 4 loyalty planeswalker that's got +2. You may sack another permanent. If you do, you gain a life and draw a card. -3, destroy target non-land permanent with CMC 3 or less. And then -9, you get an emblem with whenever a creature you control deals combat damage to a player, that player loses the game. So imagine that coupled with Stoneforge Mystic. It's got the right sword that gets protection from whatever, you know, bodies are on the opposing player's side. That's how you win a game, baby.
Yeah, it's a good value card, good grindy card. Get rid of your extra lands if you don't need them. Draw some cards off the top, you know, do a little Abrupt Decay action. Sounds good to me.
I'm just saying, Jund needs to start splashing white for Stoneforge. At least Giver of Ruins.
Four color Goyf.
So Our winners were Ruben Perez, Joel Calafell, and Esther Trujillo. CFB reported that Esther was a store owner in Spain and a six-time Pro Tour competitor, and that she was a rock of the Spanish magic scene. So it's really awesome to see her become the second female GP champion in Magic's history.
You called her a rock, and she was on John.
Yeah, that was a little bit of, you know, that was kind of a joke.
Oh, I didn't know if it was accidental or not.
Shane, that was the funniest magic joke I've ever heard.
I mean, you know me. I'm here for the humor.
Not a comedy podcast.
It's not a comedy podcast.
So there are also three modern Pro Tour qualifiers, aka MCQs, at this event.
Players Tour qualifiers, my friend.
Is this the new system that they announced recently?
Yes.
Well, there you go. PTQs are back, formerly MCQs. And they had big turnout at each. So although we don't have time to dig into all of those in today's breakdown, you can look up a lot of that information yourself at coverage.channelfireball.com and see what sort of deck list people were playing at those events.
Yeah, there was like 300-400 at each of those. So those are legit tournaments to check out.
So the winning team had 2 four-color Wurza decks. We saw a lot of Wurza decks in the deck list, etc. I think, and I keep saying it, I think Wurza is the best deck right now and is going to soon emerge to be the deck to beat. I play against it on MTGO all the time, and all the time it's incredibly difficult. And I find myself, even online, like where you have more time to think and like, okay, I do this. No, that doesn't work. I do this. And it feels like every single one of their turns is a brain teaser and a puzzle that they're pushing towards you and going, solve it or I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I feel like if you're not going for this deck's throat with, you know, very targeted hate, or you're not trying to go under it, you're going to have a challenge against it because it outvalues so many decks right now. Mm-hmm. And with the format sort of slowing down, Wurza decks just create so much value off of many of the cards in there. Even their mana fixing card replaces itself. So,
you mean Astrolabe?
Yes.
All right. I want to be that guy. I'm going to be the guy who says Wurza is fine because I have a good matchup against it. And here's what I want to say. Here I actually have some real to couple my feels. We see Wurza decks using all this unexpected and unusual technology. I mean, we just talked about Monastery Mentor as this new threat they're bringing in. And I think part of that is a response to the fact that people are figuring out how to beat Wurza because it's not so unbeatable. And I don't know, to your point, Shane, about you either have to go faster, go under it, or just have really killer hate, I feel like my counterspells are excellent against Wurza. Like, some of their most important cards just are easily countered by Spell Snare.
Sure.
I don't disagree with at all what you're saying, Stan. I think there are ways, and I think counter magic is very good, as they aren't able to typically run a lot because it dilutes their plan.
Yeah, they can't. They don't run a lot of counter spells, which is nice.
Right. You know, spinning the wheels on Wurza using his activated 5-mana ability and getting a counter spell is usually pretty bad for the most part. But I think that the deck, while it does have weaknesses, has more strengths than weaknesses. And obviously something like a Karn Great Creator is very good, as it shuts down the Thopter Sword combo, allows you to get a bridge or what have you and, you know, begin to lock them out. I just think that the deck's strengths outweigh the weaknesses. So there are ways to attack it. But I'm worried that with a deck like that, the meta begins to shift towards ways that beat it. So I don't think it's anything like Affinity, but I think it creates an environment like that where things become decks. Like, my deck is really tuned to beat Urza because I have to be able to beat Urza because there's so much of it.
I would love to talk more about this, y'all, but we got a really big dive down in front of us. So what do you think, Stan? Should we move on?
Yeah, I'm excited to get into our sideboard guide to sideboarding. We're going to take a really quick break, put together 15 cards that make no sense, and when we return, we're going to teach you how to assemble 15 cards that make more sense. Stay with us. A couple weeks ago, friend of the show Brian submitted a question that we initially considered for a wind down. But the more we thought about it and the more ideas it inspired, we felt it would make way better sense to be an entire episode. So Brian's initial question was, is the sideboard for improving your already good to decent matchups or trying to fix your horrible or bad matchups? Brian added that he's heard suggestions both ways, that you can take your 50-55% matchups to 60-65 and perhaps that's more effective than taking your 40% matchups to 50. But Ultimately, this question got us thinking about not just the answer to Brian's predicament, but also about our personal thoughts and approaches to sideboarding more broadly. In fact, way back in episode 8, we did an episode all about tweaking decks for the metagame, and sideboarding can be a part of that. But in this episode, we want to look more deeply at the 15-card sideboard itself. Talk about what type of cards can be considered for sideboards, what type of cards WotC seems to be printing specifically for this part of your 75, how you can think about approaching a sideboard and building it yourself to face the diverse modern metagame or even your local game store, how you can or should tweak your sideboard over time, as well as some common sideboard habits of more popular modern decks.
Absolutely. So we're going to start with the types of cards that are traditionally considered for sideboards. So more big genre of sideboard cards. So sort of the most typical or what gets brought up a lot is silver bullet cards. So this is obviously a reference to Killing Werewolves, which I would know nothing about. So silver bullet cards are cards that aim to stop a specific deck plan or aim to stop something very specific. So, you know, stopping a graveyard deck or stopping a combo deck, you'd bring in what is called a silver bullet card.
Well, I got to ask, Zach, do silver bullets also kill vampires?
I don't know anything about that. We can talk off mic.
I believe that's only wood stakes. So,
wooden stakes.
Cut of a wood cow.
I thought pure silver did it too.
No, okay, so it depends on what form it's in and how pure it is and where the vampire's from, but once again, off mic.
Oh yeah, this guy DMs, I forgot.
Are we talking underworld vampires or Transylvanian?
We'll say Central European. Moving on. Silver bullet cards are aiming specifically to shut down an entire deck strategy. So if a deck's using a graveyard, you know, Dredge, Living End, things like that, you might use Rest in Peace, Land of the Void, Relic of Progenitus.
Hold on, I thought Living End specifically doesn't use the graveyard.
No, it does, but it gets around Grafdigger's Cage. So it puts them into the graveyard and then has to move them out into exile, then into play from exile, but it needs to stockpile them there. So big mana decks also have silver bullet cards. Things like Blood Moon are really good at stopping Titan decks because they can't get their utility. Alpine Moon for a similar reason. Field of Ruin, good at blowing up Tron lands, and Damping Sphere as well. So there are the, you know, heavy spell decks, which are often called Xerox decks, and things like Rule of Law, Aether Sworn Canonist, Trinisphere, and new from Throne of Eldraine, Deafening Silence. These are all good because they're preventing the casting of multiple spells. So there are obviously tons of categories, tons of different deck genres that have hate cards, but that's an idea for you. So a silver bullet card or, you know, a primed hate card like that is looking to directly stop a deck's main strategy.
And it goes both ways as well, you know. Decks like Tron or Dredge might use Nature's Claim as their counter to silver bullet cards.
Absolutely. There's been plenty of times where I think I have the Blood Moon and it's nice, and then my Tron opponent, Forest, Nature's Claim, and then all of a sudden they have 10 mana and they have an Ulamog, and I lose the game.
A tale as old as time.
A song as old as rhyme.
Ulamog and Zach.
There's a tear to my eye. So I have a sort of a hypothetical question that I think maybe we know the answer to, but might be fun to hash it out. So are sort of old sideboard cards silver bullets in a way? Because all of them are trying to stop what a deck is doing, right?
So personally, I don't think this is necessarily true. And some of the cards and strategies we'll talk about, I think, help argue my point. But sometimes people just use their sideboards to outsmart the opponent's strategy. So, you know, one example that we see a lot are blue-white decks that are creature light in game one will sometimes sideboard into like big Baneslayer Angels to outplay opponents who might side out their removal spells. So I don't know if Baneslayer Angel in and of itself is a silver bullet. It's just a new threat, kind of like what Monastery Mentor did for Urza in the breakdown.
Yeah, I think actually, Zach, what I would say is that Modern is in its worst spot when the more sideboard cards are silver bullets than not. Dave kind of mentioned this last week in my absence, which was, you know, I don't like when Modern, I think most people don't like when Modern is, did you draw your hate card? Did you draw your anti-hate card? The main goal of the sideboard should be to make your deck better in certain scenarios. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the answer to that too, but I think it's a good, good question to ask is, you know, how do you conceptually envision a sideboard? Like, are you thinking that you can just stone shut off many of your opponents? Probably not.
So if one part is the silver bullets we talked about, if one part is, you know, cards that are looking to shut down these decks that are operating on pretty linear axes, Axie, Xi, X-Men, what are other cards or other genres you could pull from?
So better removal, I think, is one that a lot of people look to, or even removal in the first place. An example is Burn. So Burn doesn't run unconditional removal main. You know, sometimes they'll just have like Lightning Bolt type effects or Lightning Helix. But a lot of Burn decks will be splashing white and they'll have access to Path to Exile, which gives them access to removal that'll get rid of big creatures that don't die to Bolt. So Primeval Titan, even Core Firewalker, and Wyrmcoil Engine.
I think an important note for any Burn players out there, if you are playing against an opponent and you see they have a card in Great Creator, consider bringing in your paths preemptively, because I see Wyrmcoil more and more in sideboards. And I played against a Burn player online recently where I played a Wyrmcoil and they responded in chat, "Why do you have that? I don't have a path." So it's not an all the time thing, but they do.
That's why you have it.
Yeah, that's exactly why I have it. And it helped me to win the game. But in general, be aware that's an option that's becoming more and more frequent. So if you want to bring in path as a very clean answer to that very bad card for you, consider it.
Yeah, and sometimes more importantly than just creature removal is having access to various forms of planeswalker removal too. So I personally really like Dreadbore, but Angrath's Rampage has been seeing some play lately. You know, as blue-white control, I think, is a good example of a deck that is going to have a lot of planeswalkers in their plan no matter what. Tron sort of fits that bill as well. So if those are decks that are in your meta at your LGS or in your community, having an idea of how you're going to deal with planeswalkers and whatever colors you are playing in is, I think, a really good space to be as you start thinking about how to formulate your sideboard.
One thing that I love running, and you see a lot of decks run when they can't typically run kind of direct creature removal, or they need access to large creature removal, they're going to put it in Dismember or two in their sideboard, because it only requires generic mana and then your life total to cast it. So, you know, if you are like a blue deck or something like that, that needs access to direct removal, your choice is basically going to be Dismember.
And then finally, you have things like Sweepers, Anger of the Gods. Like for red decks, that's really the only option at the current moment. You have Damnation, Wrath of God, Day of Judgment, those type of effects. So these are things that are obviously good against go-wide decks, or if you think your opponent might be bringing in things like Monster Mentor.
Yeah, Artifact or Enchantment-based decks need to look out for these as well, because Shattering Spree, Shattering Storm, and even Fracturing Gust all see play.
And then a card type that I think we'll definitely be talking about as we talk about building sideboards are flexible cards. So these can pull like double duty. They can stretch your 15-card sideboard as far as possible. So thinking about things like a Braid, which is artifact and creature removal, Collective Brutality, which is creature removal, life gain, and a duress effect. We have Engineered Explosives that can hit all sorts of different types of permanents at certain CMCs. You know, you have a newer card like Pillage, or newer to the format at least, which can attack artifacts or lands.
Yeah, Pillage is really, really great, obviously because of the dual use of it. But it's really good for Blood Moon decks because it can tag that land that might be able to get under Blood Moon. Mm-hmm. So you hear opponent locked out and they have that one planes and they're still casting their one spell per turn, you can hit that. But then if they don't do that, you can also tag an artifact, say a mana rock they have or anything like that. So it's a card like that that where either helps your strategy a little bit or it might be able to extend your reach in a way where you previously could. That's really helpful.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with Pillage lately since it has that little line of text called can't be regenerated. So I don't care if you have a welding jar.
Oh, yeah.
That target is in the graveyard. But likewise in this category, Plague Engineer is another new card that we're seeing pop up in any deck running black to deal with tribal strategies. I mean, I know a lot of humans and elves and spirits players are really upset that this card specifically exists. The next category I'm excited to talk about, because I'm a blue player, it's counterspells. So if you're playing a blue deck that doesn't run main deck counters, or let's say you want to have access to more narrow but more powerful counters, cards like Ceremonious Rejection hits both Tron and artifact-based decks. Spell Snare, a card that I've been really pleased with lately, all about hard countering two mana spells for just one mana. Likewise, Disdainful Stroke costs one and a blue to counter anything for CMC and above. Force of Negation is a card that I think we've been seeing a split in the main and the side. A great counter to deal with combo decks, maybe when they think the coast is clear because you've tapped out. Obviously, Dispel as a way to deal with problematic instants, whether it's in Burn, whether it's War of Invention. And of course, Dovin's Veto to win counter wars.
I think what's interesting for our next section, which is Color Hosers, is you can see a decent amount of overlap between what we called silver bullet cards and what we're going to call color hosers, because color hosers are frequently just specifically designed to be that silver bullet card for your sideboard, right? So we have things like Fry and the OG Combust for blue and white spells, which also it can't be countered. So that's strong against things like Teferi, Jace, Urza. You have, you know, the classic white card Celestial Purge, which gets rid of problematic red and black permanents. So you're going to see that against things that run Blood Moon or Liliana's.
Or Koth of the Hammer.
Yeah, really powerful cards that you need to get off the board. We mentioned Veil of Summer before, provides protection against things like Can Disruption, counter spells. You know, Mono Green Tron and Primeval Titan decks are really using this to very good results.
Yeah, as Burn gets more popular, Dragon's Claw comes up as a way to gain life and almost punish them for casting red spells, but this is a card that gets exponentially better if you're in a red deck as well. One of the ultimate color hosers in my personal experience is Choke. Islands Can't Untap, and a green enchantment. Great way to kind of almost lock your blue or control opponents out from being able to cast any other spells. And we're starting to see a whole new cycle of color hosers being printed in Eldraine. So some new cards to look out for in the weeks to come. Sound Intrusion, which is the new single black hand disruption spell. Target opponent reveals his or her hand. You may choose a non-land card from your opponent's hand. If you do, your opponent exiles that card. But if it's a non-black card, then you have to exile a card from your hand as well. Another new one that I think might be interesting is Mystical Dispute. Two and a blue instant. It costs two less to cast if it targets a blue spell and counter-target spell unless its controller pays three.
A quick question for you guys. Do you consider cards like Oriok Champion, Mirren Crusader, Burrington Forge Tender, those cards with protection from certain colors, to be like hosers against that color?
It depends on the deck. Because for something like a mono red deck, like Skred, for instance, where your removal is all red based, I think it is. Because that creature is going to stick to the board and they can't do anything about it. I think it's really a case-by-case scenario, because sometimes it's going to be an annoyance or a temporary block as opposed to a hoser or a silver bullet.
Makes sense. What do you think, Stan? Do you play a lot of like creature cards like this that sort of have protection?
I have never cast any of these spells.
What about like a Core Firewalker?
Never heard of him.
How sultry. Walk him, I hardly know him.
What about a True Name Nemesis?
Love that card, but that's for the other podcast.
So, a little history lesson pop in real quick. Chair turned around, hat backwards, Dave gone once again. I'm here. I'm the sub.
Did you have these in like your super secret notes? I don't see any history lesson in here.
Well, get with it. The times are here and they're me.
Zach is hijacking this podcast.
Color hosers have actually been in Modern since its origins in 8th edition, which is a set of reprints, I know. But there's a lot of fun stuff that's really come to define the format in terms of hosers and silver bullets.
You come to define or make people upset about the format.
Oh man, people do not like number one, which is Blood Moon, my favorite card in Modern, and people do not like this card. But I think this is absolutely a silver bullet, right? In that it shuts down any deck that is looking to do things that aren't mountains.
I guess that makes sense. Like it's like a four color hoser.
Yeah, exactly.
Zach, sometimes I wonder whether you and I bonded over our shared love of red decks or whether it was our shared love of Blood Moon all along.
Yeah, it's a little bit of tempo. It's a little bit of control. You know, I'm rock and roll. You're a little bit country. We know how it goes.
Hold on, what else? There's a bunch of stuff in 8th, right?
Oh, yeah. There's Boil, which is three in a red instant, destroy all islands. And this is the spice.
Yikes.
We have Choke, like Shane mentioned. All five circle of protections are here. Goblin King, if you want to include that, as it gives Mountain Walk, but probably not really. But, you know, so there's also situational removal. We have things like Slay, which is an instant that can only destroy green creatures and draws a card.
Yeah, it costs two and a black.
Yeah, well, it's a little overcosted, but the whole point is, since Modern's foundation, there has been a history of cards that are specifically hated and targeting individual colors in Magic.
Yeah.
There's also, you know, things that, when I first started playing, I'd look at these cards and go, when is this ever relevant? Why does this matter? And it's the text, this can't be countered, and It's because I played goblins. But you have things, you know, only back in 8th edition, like Gaia's Herald, which makes creature spells uncounterable, or Obliterate, which essentially wipes the board and can't be countered. So, additional fun fact real quick, the text can't be countered appears on 68 cards in Magic, and 61 of those are Modern legal. So only 7 cards that can't be countered and make cards uncounterable aren't playable in Modern. Fun.
That's pretty wild.
History.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at this list of cards, you know, that you just spoke out to us, it's like, this feels like old. This is the end of old Magic and like the transition to new Magic, right? Like old Magic was all about a lot of pretty unfun, like, you know, hate cycles, like, you know, destroy all planes or like give things like forest walk. And it was really a lot about like just giving people the ability to sort of invalidate the vast majority of what their opponent was doing. And I think it's probably a net benefit that we moved away from that broadly.
Yeah, I think that there are definitely places for these cards. Like, you can not like Blood Moon, but it does keep a lot of greedy decks in check. And mm-hmm. it can definitely like have the side effect of like, I shut down your casual black-white zombies deck because you have to run a lot of non-basics. And that is part of it. But in general, these cards have been more moved to a role of, I think, safety valves than anything.
So we talked a little bit about kind of sideboard cards as categories, but we really wanted to get into the meat of how to build sideboards and how to think about assembling your sideboards before your next FNM or your next big modern tournament.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is really important to think about is thinking about deck types and not just decks themselves. I think it's pretty easy to think about decks in modern and the opponents you're going to face as, you know, Burn, Tron, Dredge, Blue-White Control.
Zach.
But what's really important, I think, is the types of decks you're going to be facing, because, you know, your sideboard cards need to be broad and flexible because you only have 15 cards and there's a whole lot more than 15 decks in the modern metagame. And, you know, your sideboard cards against Tron might and probably should be good against things like Amulet Titan or Titan Shift. Your sideboard cards against Dredge might help at least a little bit against things like Wurza, Hardened Scales, or Death Shadow builds. You know, that doesn't mean that every card in your sideboard is going to have a huge range of applications. You know, like we talked about just before this, some cards are going to be razors, but I think other cards are maybe like blankets. You know, you might really need that core Firewalker for that Burn Mirror from time to time, because you're going to win if your core Firewalker doesn't get path to exiled.
So I think one of the reasons people sort of fall into this, you know, it's not a trap, but into this habit of thinking about sideboarding against specific decks, I think that's because that's how a lot of like content and sideboarding conversations is happening online. You know, people are putting out sideboard guides that aren't about how to beat big mana. They're about how to beat Tron.
Yeah.
And I don't think this approach is wrong. I just think that's level two, level three thinking. And that's something you start to pick up on after you've had some experience with specific matchups.
I totally agree with that. And I think those guides are obviously helpful and those are helpful things to know, but I don't think that's a good place to start. We're saying right here is that I think it's important to know how to play against Tron, and especially if you're playing consistently at a comp RL level where you're going to see a lot of consistent tier one decks, it's important to know how to play against Tron. But I think in order to get there, you do have to start with this, which is learning not only, learning obviously the meta and what decks fall into what categories, but beyond that, you know, in my 15 cards, how many am I dedicating to combating each of these individual categories that I put these decks into?
For sure. Makes sense, Zach.
So it's really important to think about what your deck is trying to do when you're making a sideboard. So especially, you know, when you have all these options like we talked about, when you have these modal cards like a Braid, or whether you have these silver bullets like Blood Moon, I play red, not a big deal.
Yeah, really what Zach is talking about is knowing your deck's plan front to back. Like sometimes the burn deck isn't a control deck, but maybe it is in some matchups. And knowing how your deck wins across the board, I think, is really important when it comes to deciding what goes into a sideboard, especially if you have a variety of choices between sideboard cards for different applications.
Yeah, so how does that actually change the way or impact the way you make decisions?
Sure. So it's the sort of thing where, are you running Gravedigger's Cage? Are you running Rest in Peace? Are you running Relic Progenitus? Are you running Tormod's Crypt? And that's this whole thing where, are you worried about someone using the river consistently? Are you looking for the card draw that Relic gives you? Are you looking for the zero mana of Tormod's Crypt? It's really this thing where all these cards are clearly, you know, doing quote unquote the same thing, in that they're preventing graveyard strategies to a degree. But you need to think about how these individual cards are sliding into your overall strategy. So, for example, a deck like Blue-White Control is more likely to have a Rest in Peace, as they have plenty of card draw already and they're looking for a continuous effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes you have to run that full place at a Leyline of the Voids because you feel that, you know, graveyard strategies are just this must-stop threat that you're going to have a really hard time beating. Or You need to keep your graveyard intact while hurting your opponents, which we've talked about on the Leyland episode just a few weeks ago.
Likewise, maybe you don't use your graveyard a lot, and then you get to use either Rest in Peace or even Graft Digger's Cage.
Yeah, exactly.
So when given these options, knowing your role in the matchups is important, and I think trying to address how you're going to attack different plans or different deck archetypes is going to help illuminate not only what your deck is trying to do, but how you can do it most efficiently. But sometimes that also means you're going to pivot your plan as well in some cases. So, you know, people talk about transformative sideboards. Sometimes it's just adjusting the speed, and some decks can seemingly shift their plan entirely. One of the defining factors of mid-range decks, for example, is their ability to pivot between either more controlling plans or more aggressive strategies, depending on their role in a given matchup. So it's why you'll sometimes see Jund players sideboard in 8 cards, because they're doing something entirely different than they were planning to do in game one.
Absolutely, Stan. I remember when we were testing our decks for the Jund episode or LGS, I literally overheard you say, "I'm bringing in 9 cards. Is this right?" And I just feel like that is very much indicative of how a sideboard works in some decks.
Yeah, and that day half the room turned to me and said, "Yes."
That's correct. We're all on Jund and you're doing it right.
We're all bringing in 9 cards, Dan. It's normal here.
Yeah, but like a couple other examples of this. I mentioned blue-white control bringing in big angels, but you know, for a while we were seeing blue-red spells decks use Madcap Experiment and Platinum Empyrean as this clever way to sort of juke what their opponents were expecting out of the blue-red spells deck. Storm players will sometimes bring in Thing in the Ice or Empty the Warrens to basically attack on a different axis than Grapeshot, because that card in particular can be hated pretty well.
Yeah, I feel like the Empty Warrens sideboard plan is pretty similar to the Monastery Mentor plan, which has also been in blue-white control decks, where you're going wide when your opponent is going, okay, well, removal wasn't very good. I saw, you know, 3 creatures and I need to kill those, but I need to stop their combo plan as well. So that's the sort of thing where, you know, maybe a more learned or a more experienced opponent might leave in their removal, but even then you can still catch them, right? So cards like this are good because they don't take away from your main strategy and just allow you to pivot if you have to, as Dan said.
Yeah. We also see it from decks that aren't necessarily inherently mid-range game one. So like Grixis Death Shadow or Jeskai Stoneblade, they can be pretty aggro in game one, but they also have tools to side into a more grindy mid-range strategy thanks to access to different types of planeswalkers or different counterspells and removals.
Yeah, the team that I remember, yeah, they won a GP Indianapolis. The Jeskai Stoneblade player there, they had like a 1-minute Twitter deck tech with him via video. And he was like, yeah, game one, I'm kind of the, you know, the aggro mid-range plan. And then game two, I set a new control deck with my Jace of Mind Sculptors, my counter spells, my, you know, more targeted removal spells. So that was his entire plan. One of the things that I think's really interesting to talk about, and I think we might have some disagreements here, is, you know, net decking versus responding to what we consider maybe a more personal or local meta. So I know, you know, everyone is going to look at main decks from the internet, right? We're going to be looking at what people are running, how things are changing over time, what tech people are bringing in, just to learn from what's happening, right? We're also going to be looking at sideboards there too. But I think, you know, we all agree that you have to be a little bit more thoughtful about your sideboarding, right? Because certain tournaments are going to maybe have expected metas, especially at something like a Mythic Championship, because, you know, they have open deck lists and they expect a narrower metagame.
Yeah, I think really to compound on this, and I think really what I feel what Shane is saying right now is there's a difference between your local meta at your game store in your local regional area and a difference between what you're seeing at Comp Ariel, which is basically Magic Online and bigger events. So there's a time where my sideboard for Scred at my local game store was almost like 15 cards entirely different than what I'd run online just because of what I was seeing in my meta and what I could reasonably plan to face.
Yeah, that being said, I think looking at the internet for a place to start building your sideboards or even having like your first draft is totally fine. But also some data is better than others. So for instance, personally, I think I'm more interested in a sideboard that I would see in like a 5-0 deck dump. So basically people who are just playing Magic Online and can face anything, then I would feel comfortable taking a sideboard from a Mythic Championship where it's like a bunch of one-ofs and everything is all screwy since everyone has got these open deck lists.
Yeah, for sure. Zach mentioned the Magic Online metagame as well being a little bit different than what you probably face at home. I think that's really true, especially because all these deck rental services make pivoting between decks far more easy than in paper. So I think people are often going to be playing what they think is the best deck or something they want to be testing maybe against the best decks versus the cards they just have in paper. So right now, I think you're going to see a lot more Wurza on Magic Online than you are at your local game store because it's an expensive deck, has a good number of cards that don't really easily move into or out of other decks. So you're going to expect to want to have more artifact removal probably in your online metagame than at your LGS. And that's just kind of one example of many I can think of.
Yeah, for example, for exactly this matchup, online I run Shattering Spree, but in paper in that slot I run an Abrade. And I feel like in paper I like that removal, I like that option, but the ability to destroy a ton of artifacts is better for me because of these artifact-heavy matchups that I see online.
That's kind of interesting for me to hear this. I don't think this necessarily warrants a bigger discussion, but my approach is actually quite a bit different. I try to be consistent between online and paper so that I have as much experience basically once I'm in paper to translate all the learning I've done online.
I think we'll get to kind of my thoughts on that topic later, Stan, for sure. But yeah, I think that's a good concept to think about. And I think people can have different opinions on it, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I think, too, you're going to see formats shift and adapt, right? So older sideboards that you might see on NetDecks. And older in modern can mean like 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Burn comes out of, say, SCG Denver. It kills it there. Because people weren't prepared for it. And then in a matter of a week or two, you might see even an overcompensation for that. And Burn kind of shrinks back down. And your 5-card, 6-card sideboard against Burn or aggressive decks is no longer that valid. And so that can really happen quickly. So this is where I think we're going to have a little bit of a can of worms, a Pandora's box, a delightful case of Wonka sweets. So a lot of the local game stores, right, don't reflect the Magic Online meta, the tournament meta. You know, you might see a lot of tribal decks. You might see a lot of Tron. You might feel like everyone in your store runs Midrange. You might feel everyone in your store runs Stoneforge right now.
There is a week at Dice Dojo where me and Stan play, where there were 3 Scred players, which is not, I think, happened at any other location at any point in time ever. So just to prove that the local meta can be very interesting and distinct from what's going on around it.
What I feel, though, and I've experienced this, that I've played at a lot of different stores. You know, I've moved a lot. I've moved a lot in Chicago. I moved to Denver. I've played at a couple stores here. No matter where I play, I feel like metagaming for what I consider to be the local meta to be a losing battle. You know, I feel that, like, most players are bringing different decks every week. There's different players showing up all the time, even though there is a core of regulars that come. I just feel like I can't predict what the local meta is going to be. And if I try, you know, they might be testing out Stoneforge Mystic this week. Mm-hmm. That's just my experience.
I agree somewhat. On the one hand, I like to be kind of broad for this reason, because I think in a big city like Chicago or in Denver, you are going to encounter a larger pool of players who can bring almost anything. But I still do think it's really important to pay attention to your surroundings and not just the latest deck dumps. You know, there are periods where I'll feel like I haven't seen Tron in months, and then I might stop running like Ceremonious Rejection, for instance. And I think, I mean, maybe I'm losing some equity to the occasional Tron player who shows up in the room, but, you know, if that person skipped town because they robbed a bank, I'm not going to ruin my sideboard since they're on the lamb.
I like this metaphor, real or not.
It is not based off any true events or any pending litigation against the dive down.
I mean, I think that's really important, right, Stan, is pay attention to your surroundings. I think that, you know, it's important to both pay attention to what's around you, but also not over predict. And I think you're right in saying, you know, stay broad in a broad metagame and try to get narrow in a narrower metagame, I think is kind of the fundamental point we're trying to make here. One of the things that I think is really important to understand, too, is to really get what the cards in your sideboard are actually doing, why they're there, what you want to use them for. And this is kind of an argument against just raw net decking a sideboard. You know, if you see 2 Ashiok Dream Render in a sideboard and you don't really know what you're going to bring it in against, don't run that card. Or learn why the card's in there. You know, learn, well, ask some people, you know, find the Discord for the deck that you like to play and say, you know, I'm thinking about running this, but I don't really know what it's great against. And people are very happy to share their opinion with you.
Oh, the phrase, several people are typing, shows up an awful lot there.
You know, what decks am I bringing in Force of Negation against? If you don't know why it's there, you know, if you don't know why the card's there, take the time, think it over, understand why it's there, or use cards that you're more confident in their usage and their application.
I think this is something that can be applied in a different way as well, where if you find yourself with a sideboard and you're never bringing a card in that you put there, why aren't you bringing it in?
Mm-hmm.
Is it that you don't think it's relevant? Is it that you're overlooking it? I think in general, this is sort of a thing where if a card's in your sideboard, you need to know why it's in your sideboard, and it needs to be used. Obviously, if you play Tron over and over and over again, you're not going to use your burn hate or your aggro hate, whatever. But you need to be aware of the role the sideboard cards play and when to bring them in.
For sure.
So let's talk a little bit about how to prepare for an expected meta. So let's say you are really aware of your surroundings. You do have an idea of what people in your community are playing. And generally, this is really hard, but let's say you're prepping for a big tournament and you need to basically have a plan against the biggest decks in the format. And, you know, sometimes, like in the case right now, it feels like there's 6 to 10 really big decks that you could bump into at any time. So how do we prepare our 15 most impactful cards if we're going off of a hunch of what we're going to face on a given day? Personally, like I mentioned, I like to be somewhat flexible, but that also means knowing what I'm doing in a variety of matchups. So if I'm going to the local game store, I'll actually think about, what do I do if I face Zach? Since I know I always have a chance of being paired against Zach.
Wait, Zach Callahan? Me?
Just a nameless, faceless person named Zach.
With 6'3", fair-skinned.
5'8", tan. Whereas for bigger tournaments, so like let's say I'm going to the MCQ, sometimes I'm going thinking, as we talked about earlier, what's my plan for these big mana decks? Because I could face Tron, I could face, you know, a Titan deck. Or what's my plan for Jund and mid-range strategies? And what are my plans for aggro creature decks? And I think the outcome here is that you tend to, on the one hand, be a little bit more spread out in your plan and your sideboard strategy. But also the benefit is that you might out-prepare an opponent who didn't expect to face your strategy or who didn't expect you to sideboard as well as you did.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think is important too, and one of the reasons we do the breakdown every week, is that we want to keep tabs and help you keep tabs on what is happening in the modern meta, right? So things are constantly in flux. Like I mentioned earlier, just about burn. You know, I heard on a, you know, Arena deck list that Jerry and Brian were like, you know, burn is probably tier one now, but in like 2 weeks, probably be tier two, because people are going to respond to it and have better strategies against it. And won't be able to take advantage of kind of a, you know, meandering and less tuned metagame, right? So, you know, things in the breakdown section age really poorly. And we're aware of that, because things that happened in June don't matter much to people listening to the episode right now.
You mean Hogak? You mean Hogak?
You know, we had some hot and good Hogak content for that 2 week period.
Some hot gacks.
So, you know, but keeping an eye on what's happening in the tournament results can help you inform, you know, your upcoming sideboard decisions, right? Because you want to be able to say, I understand the trends. I see what's going up. I see what's going down. I see what I think is maybe being able to take advantage of an opportunity here. And that's going to allow you to respond to that with how you sideboard and build your sideboard.
And that's even happening right now, right? We've been talking about Urza, Tron, and Burn a lot. Jund, too, for that matter. So these are some of the specific decks that you get to think about, whether or not you want to even sideboard for them at all. Like, maybe you don't necessarily need to have sideboard slots against Burn because your main deck is strong against them already.
So that's a great talk about what to expect when you're going to a game store or maybe a bigger tournament. But what if you're going somewhere for the first time, right? What if you're new in town, you're going to a local game store, and you're not going to bring a highly tuned sideboard? So I think this is a good time to talk about going into an unexpected or new meta. And I think this is really where those modal cards you talked about earlier really shine. So if you're unsure about artifact decks, a Braid or Pillage are good cards to bring in as well. Or if you are running black-red, you have things like Dreadbore or Bedevil as well for these, or Kolgon's Command even. So my personal take is, if you're going into an unknown meta, have your sideboard be as diverse as possible. I think in those situations, it's better to cast a wider net and hope to hit decks than it is to specifically hit out one deck.
For sure. I think that's why you're going to see things like Celestial Purge in most decks running white, because like you said, you know, it's cost effective and it's wide. And it's a lot of different things. You know, hits black and red permanents of all types. That's ideal. You know, I was going to agree, if you didn't say Abrade is one of my personal favorite cards right now, because it's cost efficient and it hits two very different strategies.
I got four main deck in prison right now. You kidding me?
I'm right there with you, Zach. I love that card so much, I just put it in my 60. You know, as long as we're talking about unknown meta, I think this is also a good opportunity for dedicating some number of sideboard slots for what we will refer to as a transformative plan, right? So this is kind of the opportunity when your blue-red deck gets to sideboard in Madcap Experiment and Platinum Empyrean. Because if you don't know what you necessarily need to hate out, now you get to spend those extra 15 cards thinking about how you get to operate your plan A even better, or how you can attack a variety of decks in ways that they might not expect.
Yeah, a specific example I can think of for, like, say I was going across the country and was playing in like a win-a-box at an LGS, right?
Whoa, big energy there.
You can't lose a single match, Shane, if you're winning a box.
So, that would be not a scenario where I would be like, okay, my burn deck's going to have four core Firewalkers. Like, sure. If I was going to like an SCG, right? I might have like two Takali Honor Guard and two core Firewalkers, mm-hmm. and a couple of Braids, and be as, you know, a few Path of Exiles just for any creature I need to get off the board. Because, you know, that Takali Honor Guard hits a lot of things tangentially. Like, it hits, you know, the Urza deck, it hits humans, it hits, you know, what, there's all sorts of decks that rely on ETB effects.
It stops the copter, the sword combo as well, because it relies off the creature entering the battlefield, so it does not trigger the sword.
Yeah, whoa. It's got a high amount of value, just like people are very high on Torpor Orb lately. So, you know, those are things that I think that you would want to have probably a lot more two ofs and a lot less four ofs. So should we get into the actual original question after an hour or so?
Yeah, Brian, we did not forget about you.
I did.
We've sort of been...
Sorry, Brian. Zach's forgetful.
I did not forget about Brian. Yeah, we've sort of been circling around this question, but I think it's still an important one we want to address head on. Is the sideboard for improving your already good matchups, or is it trying to fix your horrible matchups? And Brian says he's heard suggestions both ways. And we all have, I think, our own opinions on this topic, too.
What do you think, Zach?
So personally, I find that my sideboards really work best for me, or help me, when they are taking my 50% matchups to 60%. So this isn't a hard and fast rule. Once again, if you're in a meta where, like, there's 20 people and 10 of them are on a deck, side for that deck. Like, even if it's a bad matchup and you really want to play the deck you're playing, side for that deck. But in general, I really like being able to take my fringe matchups a little further. And I think that's because typically I play mid-range or grindy decks. So I feel like anything that can give me that little push or chutzpah at the end can be really good. So I also find that if a strategy is really good against me and I have an abysmal win rate, I don't know if this is correct, but my plan is hope you don't play it. And sometimes that works out and you get to win. So I would rather shore up my okay matchups to make sure I have a better win rate than try to mess with something that I feel like is an uphill battle already.
So you're saying that you will somewhat punt your, let's say, 30% matchups that you don't think you can get past, you know, 45.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are, like, for example, I don't have a Damping Sphere in my sideboard for decks right now with the Karn package, because I feel like that's not an artifact I have room for. And then I might play something like Storm. And if I don't have my ley lines, it's, oh, crap, they cast all these spells and I didn't have the one thing that could stop them. And of course, you know, you're only bringing in one or two of them and, you know, there's only so many chances of finding it or getting it in a game. But I think that you do, you know, give up a certain chance of winning or having a fight in a game in order to make your blade a little sharper in other fights.
Mm-hmm. Stan, what do you think?
So I think whenever I have a really horrible matchup, or at least a matchup I perceive as bad, I'm actually more likely to tweak my 75 than just focus on the sideboard as a way to improve that. So ultimately, to answer Brian's question, I'd rather spend my sideboard slots developing a plan that I know will help me win games more consistently. And if there's a strategy where I feel like I have a horrible matchup, maybe at that point I consider adjusting my 60 to have you know, a slightly more refined plan. So an example of this concept, I think, is what we see Tron players occasionally do with main deck Thragtusk, because historically that deck really struggles against burn or super aggressive strategies.
Yeah, I had one played against me at the MCQ this weekend. You know, they made turn three Tron and were able to cast a Thragtusk against me, and I was playing burn, and that felt real bad.
You know, I can color this topic with a personal anecdote as well. So lately I've been playing a lot of Blue Moon, and forever I've always thought that burn was a really bad matchup. And I shifted my main deck a little bit, reflecting on what I've seen other streamers and Blue Moon pilots do in the meta and tournaments and 5-0 dumps. And I've kind of found that my suite of planeswalkers really can be the deciding factor in how I manage that matchup in particularly. So if you're, for instance, casting like Rao, is it Viceroy over Jace? That might have an impact on, you know, one matchup really profoundly and have a much smaller impact on a wider swath of matchups.
Stan, what you're getting at, I think, is really important and I think kind of a neglected aspect of sideboarding. And we didn't mention it in kind of an earlier section, but you bringing this back up, maybe think of it again, is some of the better players that have ever played the game. One of them wrote an article in which they talked about thinking about their entire 75 more than just their 60 plus their 15, right? So they said things like, I want to have access to four of these across my 75, but I don't want to dilute my sideboard by having four of them in there. So I run one main deck so that I still have the ability to side in three more. And I think we see something like that happening with Burn lately, where they're having one or two main deck Skullcrack to handle the response to the popularity of Burn, and maybe having one or two more in their sideboard because they can't have four Skullcrack over there because it's just too many. So I think that is something that's important to think about, and I think that it happens less often than it should, which is, does this spell that might be feel like a sideboard card still have enough main deck utility that it doesn't hurt me to run, but I still want to have access to my entire 75 as a flexible entity? Because you're only playing 33% of your games, potentially, with your game one deck, but you're playing an awful lot more with your post-sideboard deck. But that being said, y'all, I gotta crack my vocal knuckles here. I have a lot to say on this topic to answer Brian's question. So what I prefer to think about in terms of improving my already good matchups or fixing my bad matchups is really what is going to make the largest net growth to my win percentage across an expected field, right? So I've heard and read numerous pros kind of talk about this concept, but I think it's really challenging to think about and even harder to execute upon, because it's really hard to know exactly what you're going to be facing, especially at the LGS level, like we mentioned, right? So what I'm really saying is you should select your sideboard cards not based on like the perceived percentage that you expect to see different decks or types of decks, but on kind of the broad net benefit you expect to gain against the field in its entirety. So, you know, here's like an example, right? Let's say you believe that aggressive burn-like decks are going to have 10% of the field, and four cards in your sideboard is going to increase your win percentage by 20%. So let's say you go from 40 to 60%, right? If a big mana decks like Tron also have 10% of the field, but four anti-big mana cards in your sideboard only increase your win percentage by 5% because you already have a pretty good matchup against them, or maybe you have such a terrible matchup against them like Skred or something like that, the value of the anti-aggro cards, it's much higher, even though both those decks occupy 10% of the field in total.
Yeah, I think this is almost what Zach was referring to when he talks about if you have a really horrible matchup, you're almost better off just trying to skip that matchup entirely.
But also I think that Zach, to me, sounds like he might be being a little fatalistic, right? Because like it's really hard to know and understand, you know, what percentage gain you can really get from a sideboard. And so I think saying, well, my game one is 30, I'm just going to punt it altogether because my game one is so bad, without perhaps taking, you know, in its entirety, what he can gain by, say, having seven cards for anti-big mana and having, you know, and shaving down to maybe two cards for anti-aggro, one card for anti-mid-range, things like that, right? Versus saying, you know, I need to have three for anti-aggro because I'm going to see 15% of the metagame be aggro decks, even if you already have a great aggro matchup and those cards aren't doing that much for you. So it's really thinking about where you are going to see the biggest gain from your sideboard in the cards that you're adding. So what I try to do, how I execute upon this concept, if I'm really trying to build a tournament sideboard, you know, is evaluate the net benefit of each card I'm going to run by thinking about the expected field, my general feeling, because I don't think you can have really great stats about matchups of each strategy type, and how often I expect to see each type of strategy. So I can say something to myself like, my matchup against Wurza is 40%. And I think if I go deep in this tournament, maybe even something like 20% of the field in the last three rounds could be all Wurza. And these five cards in my sideboard are going to take my matchup from 40% to maybe 60%. But they're also going to be valuable against random affinity, hardened scales, prison, even Tron, which I also think will be pretty heavily represented. So if you go through that process long enough, and you ask yourself that question about all sorts of different deck types and deck strategies and even specific decks, you can identify what cards you are considering just because they're good against decks you think you're going to face versus what cards you think are actually the most valuable for you across the broader tournament because of how powerful they make your post-sideboard deck. Does this make sense? Do you guys hear what I'm saying? Do you think I'm crazy?
I think this makes a lot of sense, and it's a great way to put into context how to make challenging decisions a little easier. Because, you know, the sideboard is something that I myself have obsessed about, I think to my own detriment. And I think it's because it's so flexible and it can be like a variety of colorless cards or dismembers or what have you, or like hyper-specific color hosers. It's really easy to fall into this rabbit hole of like thinking you're going to win or lose based on your ability to decide those last two cards. But if you're able to maybe start to evaluate the broader benefit of those 2 to 4 to 15 cards, you might start to see a general trend toward improvement over your overall performance over time.
Stan, I'm totally with you on that. When I started taking Magic, or Modern Magic specifically, a little more seriously and going to more tournaments and, you know, reading strategy and stuff, I kept hearing this phrase over and over again that sideboarding is the most important skill in Modern. And what I took that to mean was, like you said, do I bring in this card or not? And is this how I win or lose the game? But I think more of what I'm taking from that now and how I'm viewing that now is what we're talking about in this episode, where it's how you build the sideboard and how you view it and how what role these cards are playing and how you're envisioning them in your overall game plan. So I do think sideboarding is definitely among the top important skills to have in Modern, but that's not just if you bring in this one card or not. It's knowing what the strategy is and how your cards are furthering that strategy or stopping your opponent's strategy.
Yeah, I think the real hard part though is executing on this in a really objective manner. I think it's nearly impossible to kind of say, you know, I think that these cards will increase X type of matchup X percent. Because a lot of that is just like how it feels, right? Versus kind of, you know, hundreds of games or even dozens of games of experience. But I think the process is what's important because it will make you think about your decisions in really important ways. And it makes you think about the cards that you want to bring and when you will and won't need to bring them in and what is the balance between flexibility and specificity. I think all of those things are really what are going to help you piece together that ideal 15 for a given weekend or even a given trip to your LGS versus just kind of carbon copying, you know, 14 of the 15 cards you saw in the latest 5-0 dump because that's what won that week. You know, then we say all this, right? And then you just like face Living End round one and you lose because that's Modern.
Sure. I mean, when you have a really diverse card pool and a lot of different viable decks, that does happen.
Basically, the advice there is if your opponent starts cycling creatures into the graveyard on turn one, scoop.
Well, no, scoop.
Immediately.
My mom says I got to go home. So I think this is a great time to note that when you're building a sideboard, especially for a local meta, you shouldn't do it reactively in sort of a knee-jerk way. And this is something that I definitely did during my journey to becoming a better modern player, where, you know, there would be weeks where I was 3-0 my LGS and I would happen to play this Assault Lone player and they would beat me. My thought would be like, oh, dang it, like if I had 3 more Pith Needle effects in my sideboard, I'd had them. And then I bring those in, right? Mm-hmm. And this was a real thought that I had. So yeah, I did indeed.
Three, huh?
I bought 3 foil Sorceress Spyglass and I don't want to talk about it.
My dude.
And then I brought them in and I saw their other applications and I did end up running 2 consistently after a while. But it was 3 was too many, and like I didn't need it in that moment in general. So you don't want to aggressively sideboard to against one player or one strategy. And like you can keep in mind if you played them what you'd bring in, and it's smart to be thinking in that bigger game. But I would not be so quick to, you know, be changing out 5 or 6 cards in order to potentially hate someone you might not even play at your LGS.
So let's then talk a little bit about when and how often we do want to tweak our sideboards. Because I personally prefer to tweak fairly often.
Always be tweaking.
Always be tweaking. I will sometimes tweak every week or two, and not because I think I'm going to attack a deck better per se, but I think it's because I find opportunities to execute my plan better. All right. And sometimes that's because I'm experimenting with new tools as well. Like maybe it's trying Surgical Extraction next to my Abrade or next to my Pillage to see if that's going to help improve a matchup that may have been challenging otherwise.
Yeah, I think this is the benefit, Stan, that you see from, I think, going to your LGS a few times a week or maybe just once a week at this point. That's still a lot more than a lot of people do. And, you know, we test online, you know, you play decks that you just want to have fun with online a little bit more than I'm able to, at least. And I think that that is a great way to be learning and seeing how certain cards are performing. And just, you know, it's one of those things where you have to collect enough data to make semi-informed decisions. That's the best we're going to get in modern, is semi-informed, right?
It's better than not informed.
I prefer making broad generalizations from very small sample sizes.
Yeah, that's true.
That's how you know you're a good Magic player, yeah.
I find myself playing so many different decks that when I come back to the same one again, the sideboard's already pretty different because the metagame has shifted in some fashion. So, you know, it's a consequence of my just interest in playing new decks, my general inability to play more than our testing for the episode. So like, you know, when we're doing a deck dive, I'm playing a different deck. And then, you know, I'll be maybe testing something new that I bought into that week. Like I'm going to, you know, take humans to the LGS or Stoneforge gets unbanned. So I'm going to test some Stoneforge out. And so when I eventually circle back to, you know, be playing Burn again or be playing humans again, you know, something, some new cards added to the format or the format's changed in a way where I have to tweak.
I also think when new sets come out, that's a great opportunity to tweak. Not only because you get to experiment with some new cards and like a lot of times sets will have cards that really seem sideboard specific, but also this is a great way to start catching people off guard. Because no one's going to expect you to bring in that crazy new counter spell that only costs 1 mana if it's targeting another blue spell.
This is big feels versus reels energy for me here, but I love when a new set comes out and I sideboard in a card, for example, Land of Combustion back when that was new. My opponent reads it, passes it back, reads it again, and then one more time goes, I'm sorry, wait, what? And it's just like...
Sighs deeply.
Yeah, it's like, yes, I am in control of the situation right now. I know the text and you do not. And it's just a fun moment.
And cards have so much text in them these
days.
Oh
my goodness. It used to be they had to limit themselves to 7 lines, and then I think they allowed themselves to shrink text sometimes.
Yeah, they were like, we can go to 4 point now.
Yeah, exactly.
So Zach, what do you think about tweaking, my friend? Tell me about your tweak style.
So my tweak style is infrequent, but intense.
Go on.
So I think overall, when I tweak, I only tweak when I feel like a card isn't working for me or I've been consistently let down. I know Stan's someone who likes to change it up often and is looking for new decks, even like, you know, hey, on this week, I'm on this strategy and, you know, I'm trying elves this week or whatever. For me, I like to stick with what works. And if I'm playing Prison, for instance, and I was playing Seasoned Pyromancer, and in some games, they'd be amazing blowouts. In other games, I would have to not cast them because I don't want to discard the cards in my hand. So in that situation, I took those out and put in goblins like Legion War Boss, for example. So in general, I do like to tweak, but I tweak more as a last resort than a preemptive choice. For my sideboard, though, different discussion. I love to sort of, ooh, this could be good here, or ooh, a new fancy card, let's see what happens there. But in general, for my main deck, I'm a little more of a hardliner about that, a little more of a carpetbagger, so to speak, don't want to touch it. But it comes to sideboard, I'm willing to just throw stuff out the window and see where it goes.
All right, that was a long way of saying you're a massive tweaker to your sideboard, my friend.
Yeah, a little bit. I like to, run it through the ringer, so to speak.
So we're not totally finished yet, but we're getting there. And one of the last sections that I'm really excited to talk about are some really common level one sideboarding habits to be aware of when you're playing against certain pillar decks in the format. So, for example, of this section and the concept, if you're playing against Tron and Dredge, they very often bring in Nature's Claim effects to deal with enchantments or different cards to deal with artifacts, because the hate for these decks is so often enchantment and artifact based, and removing these types of permanents is essential.
For sure. Yeah, like, I mean, I played Tron, I played Dredge. You are bringing in your Nature's Claims because you can't beat a ley line very easily. You're not going to beat a Damping Sphere or a Blood Moon very easily. You need those off the board, so you can expect those to be brought in against you.
I mentioned this a couple times. I'll reiterate one last time. If you're playing against blue-white control and they seem threat light in game one, they will often bring in creature-based threats for game two to try to capitalize on players who take out their removal spells. So let's say you are in a deck that also has Path to Exile. That's a card that I tend to keep in games two and three against control, because I still want to have an answer to Baneslayer Angel, and I want to have a quick removal spell for Monastery Mentor.
Will you do that game two? A lot of the strategies I've seen will be like, okay, bring in maybe two paths if you're burn to prepare for Core Firewalker, you know, well, where it still is going to have some value in the mirror against their aggressive creatures, right? But if you see Core Firewalker, then you bring in your full three or your full four if you're running the playset, because you know they have it. So an example I can think of is, say, the Dredge Mirror, right? Where you will wait to see a Leyline of the Void on the other side, because it isn't necessarily something that you're going to even have in your Dredge sideboard, right? So if your opponent is on the other side thinking, this person has Leyline of the Void, I need to bring in my Leyline of the Void hate cards, I'm going to bring in four Nature's Claims, right? While they're diluting, all they're doing is diluting their Dredge plan by losing the engine cards and having kind of fairly useless sideboard cards against a card you didn't even bring in. So that's something that I would typically do in the mirror, is not expect to see Leyline of the Void. I'm not going to dilute my game plan until I see it. That's just something that I think about sometimes. Do you think will you do that with blue-white control? Will you just assume they're going to have angels to bring in, and you'll bring in Path to Exile effects or removal?
I think blue-white control players want you to think that their threats aren't creatures, but whether it's Celestial Colonnade, whether it's an angel, whether it's Combustible Gear Hulk, at a certain point they're going to start swinging. The exception there, perhaps, is if they ultimate a Jace.
Yes, you're going to eat something, is what you're saying.
You will almost always find something to eat. You're not going to go hungry in that matchup.
I mean, but then also is saying, like, you may be diluting your necessarily game plan, like you said earlier, which is, you know, do you need to go under blue-white control before they stabilize? Like, if they're swinging in with a Celestial Colonnade, it's not like you pathing it is going to make you able to win. Mm-hmm. You have to be putting the clock down, right?
Because mm-hmm. That's at least turn six if they're swinging with a Colonnade.
All I can think about in regards to Stan's comment is, you know, the famous painting of this is not a pipe and it's a pipe, of this is not a threat and it's just a picture of, you know, the angel.
Ain't nothing to see here. I don't see anything at all.
So another good strategy to talk about in this section is the new hotness in town, Stoneforge Mystic. A lot of Stoneforge decks out there, they're sideboarding in swords very often. And sometimes you have to expect them to side in a sword that's going to make it harder for you to cast your targeted removal, or make it harder for you to profitably block with creatures of a certain color.
Yeah, or block at all.
So I play Blue Moon a lot, and something that I will sometimes do, and something I've picked up from other Blood Moon players, is if you have Blood Moon in your 75, and this is whether it's in your main or your sideboard, I will sometimes take my Blood Moons out if I'm on the draw, because I find that they can, in some cases, be quite a bit worse, especially if Blood Moon is a card that's kind of edging on whether it's good or bad. You know, if it's Tron, I'm always bringing Blood Moon in, play or draw. But if it's something like Blue-White Control, where I'm just trying to shut off their colonnades, or something like Affinity, where I'm trying to shut off their creature lands as well, I might leave the Blood Moon out if I'm on the draw.
So it's interesting to me, as someone who plays a lot of heavy Blood Moon decks, I usually won't cut all of them in the same way, but I will look to them for early cuts as well, especially if I'm on the draw, like you said. I keep talking about how an early Blood Moon is a better Blood Moon, and if you are back a turn because you went second, that is a slower Blood Moon. But in general, unless I think that they are going to completely be able to fetch around it or run enough basics, or I think that they are a deck like maybe Blue Moon or Phoenix, where my Blood Moon wasn't good in the first place, I'll cut it. But if I think I can get any mileage, I'll usually leave at least two in. And I think this is a similar argument for Chalice of the Void, where you can shave a few if you need to fit in some sideboard slots, and having a number is still good, especially if you can level two your opponent and they think you set out all your cards and they don't Blood Moon anymore, but then you play a turn four Blood Moon and it actually is pretty good still. But in general, I won't cut all of them, but that is a good place to look if you only need one or two more slots.
Oh, it's a cool topic. It makes me think as well, speaking of removing things, because so often when we think about sideboarding, we think about adding things, but really the removing is what's much more challenging, I've found, historically. Recently, I've been playing some Burn again. I was practicing some Burn and playing Burn at the MCQ this past weekend. It went poorly, but, you know, that's what happens sometimes.
Well, sometimes chickens, sometimes feathers.
Yeah, some days you get the chicken, some days you get those feathers, and it was a feathery day. So with Burn, you often will remove your Eidolons on the draw, because you're not able to get them down in time for them to have a lot of value against your opponent, and they'll hurt you perhaps more than they're even hurting your opponent. So especially things like, you know, Affinity, where they're playing so many spells before turn two on their play. You know, when you're on the draw in turn two, you're not going to get a lot of value on it. And in fact, it's going to hurt you as you try to play control against them and remove their creatures and things like that. Also, something that I've seen Burn do post-sideboard for removing is, you know, and other decks can do this too, is if you don't run a lot of creatures. Like, Burn doesn't need its creatures unless it's really trying to go quick and go under certain strategies. So, like, in a mid-range strategy, so let's say you're playing against something like Jund, and Jund has a pile of removal that it wants targets for so that they don't have dead cards in hand. Many Burn players suggest removing all of your creatures, except for Eidolon of the Great Rebel. Because, yeah, the game will go long. You'll blank cards in the Jund opponent's hand. You'll be able to play your burn spells to, you know, hurt them, and their cards are effectively dead. And even if they remove an Eidolon of the Great Revel, it costs them the removal spell, and it costs them, more importantly, two life.
So, Shane, I heard you say that, and I went, that can't be right. Then I thought, and Assassin's Trophy, Abrupt Decay, Fatal Push, like all these cards your opponent just goes, oh no, these are bad now. And then say there's even a game three after that, maybe they take those out and you could even bring the creatures back in if you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, they might think that you just didn't see them. So, I mean, you can out-level yourself there. But
I just clearly did in front of everybody.
No, I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of that strategy, is, you know, trying to blank cards that your opponent can't possibly remove, because it's kind of one of the backbones of their strategy.
Sure.
Is something that's perfectly perfectly acceptable and probably a good idea from time to time.
Which is another reason why, again, I'm going to rag on this point, why modal cards are so good in Modern right now. Because it is very hard to blank two modes on a card. So in general, if you can, once again, spread a wide net and have cards do multiple things, less of a chance that you just can't cast them.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of, you know, black-based mid-range decks, they're often going to have Collective Brutality.
Ooh, they sure will.
You know, and it's funny because it's both flexible and surgical. So it's surgical against a deck like Burn, because it can remove a creature, it can gain life, and it can remove an instant or a sorcery, you know, burn spell from their hand. Hugely surgical there. But in a lot of other situations, it's flexible. You can use it as kind of a duress-like effect. You can use it as life gain. You can use it as a, you know, small creature removal when it's not quite as surgical as it is against Burn, but it's certainly bring-inable in against many strategies.
Yeah, I think one of the scariest entities to have to think about and worry about when thinking about how your opponent is going to sideboard is the vast variety of colorless hate cards.
Oh, yeah.
So, for instance, if you're on Amulet Titan or Tron or Storm, or is it Phoenix running for, is it Charm? I think you almost always have to be prepared for your opponent to run Damping Sphere, assuming Damping Sphere isn't hate against them as well. A lot of times when I was playing Izzet Phoenix, I would just bring in a Braid preemptively, just because, you know, worst case it's a removal spell for a little creature, but best case it deals with a Damping Sphere or a Grafdigger's Cage or a really flexible colorless hate card, artifact like hate card.
Dragon's Claw, perhaps.
Maybe even a Dragon's Claw that anyone can seemingly bring in out of nowhere. And some of the newest technology that I think is growing in popularity increasingly and blowing out a lot of players, including some of the hosts on this show, Veil of Summer and Weather the Storm. So Jund and other decks with access to green are turning to Weather as an answer to the growing popularity of Burn. So
yeah, this weekend, my Tron opponent, my mono green Tron opponent, flashed me that card from her sideboard. She says, "This is where I am right now."
And I think it's great.
That's a really funny way to phrase it.
I think it's really great. It's an instant spell. So if you time it right, you can either cast it as the second spell in the turn, so you gain 6 life, but maybe it's like the third or fourth spell, and that's when you start getting 3 times however many spells have been cast, including the Storm spell itself. So I think Weather the Storm is a great inclusion for the format. Likewise, Veil of Summer is a protection spell coming out of sideboards with access to green. So Tron, different types of Primeval Titan decks, even Infect and Neoform are all using it to blank discard effects and counter spells. Likewise, if you're playing against me, I will almost always certainly sideboard in Rampaging Ferocidon against you.
Modern staple.
It doesn't matter what deck you're on. I'm convinced that this is the best creature in Modern right now.
Are you? No, that can't be right.
Name a better creature.
Not a one.
I don't think you can.
No, you got me.
Ferocidon beats all of them.
Yeah. Fair, fair.
So there you have it, folks. Now you know everything you need to know about building the perfect sideboard.
You know an okay amount. You know something. You know what we thought you should know.
I think it's a good summary.
Tune in next week to find out when you shouldn't sideboard cards at all. For now, we're going to take a really quick break. And when we return, we've got some co-host check-ins up our sleeve. Stay with us.
So, we really made a listener's question the entire premise of our dive down today. So, that'd be fun, and maybe we could ask each other some questions for our wind down section.
Oh, man, I love asking questions. And more importantly, I love hearing you guys answer them.
I love talking, and I love waiting with bated breath for me to talk again.
That's the best quality of a friend and a co-host.
Yeah, absolutely. That's collaboration at its finest. So, we talked about sideboard cards. We talked about certain strategies, how to bring in certain cards, how to think about sideboards. But I want to know what you think about sideboards. More importantly, I want to know what you want to put in a sideboard. In a sideboard today, right now. What can I do to get you in this sideboard today?
You know what I love? I love creatures with protection from colors. I kind of mentioned some of them earlier, especially the ones with passive abilities. So whether it's like Oriok Champion or Core Firewalker or like Mirran Crusader, they can be so annoying for my opponents to face down that it kind of brings like this evil joy to my heart. And also I love how it feels like winning the lottery a little, like when you draw one of those, you know, silver bullet cards that really hoses things and you get to play it and it's nearly impossible for them to remove it. And you're just like, yep, this is winning me the game single-handedly. It's like the best and worst part of Modern.
So I think this is my chance to defend myself a little bit, because I'm going to say it again. My new favorite sideboard card of late, specifically in Blue Moon, which is the deck I've been focusing on the most, is Rampaging Ferocidon.
Stan, could you tell us what that card does?
I would be absolutely happy to, since this card was extinct in Modern. I think when it got banned in Standard, people just assumed they shouldn't play it in Eternal formats too.
I mean, that might be fair, even if it wasn't banned.
All right, so this is an Ixalan, Dinosaur, Tuna Red, Menace, players can't gain life. Whenever another creature enters the battlefield, Rampaging Ferocidon deals 1 damage to that creature's controller. So, I started playing this in my sideboard as a way to answer the Wurza Thopter Sword combo in particular. Sure. They can still make as many creatures and Thopters as they want, but they're no longer gaining life, and each of those Thopters are hurting them a little bit. Plus, in a deck with Thing in the Ice, I can just bounce all those Thopters right back. But I also found over time that this creature has some added utility across a lot of other strategies. So it's pretty okay against Dredge at shutting down the life gain they get from Creeping Chill. Likewise, they'll start taking a bunch of damage from all the creatures coming in from their graveyard, assuming I can't enter their graveyard already.
Looking at you, Bloodghast.
I also kind of like it against some of these Bant Soulholder Herder strategies that are just constantly blinking creatures for value. So on the one hand, they are getting some value out of the blink effects, like drawing cards from Ice Fang Coatl. But at the same time, every time their Soul Herder does a thing, they're taking damage for it. But lastly, for the deck that I'm running it in, it's just another threat, and it's an evasive threat. And I think when you're running control and people are not expecting you to have a bunch of creatures, I think being able to protect it with Force of Negation or, you know, the rest of your counterspell suite, it's just another way to try to close out a game that might otherwise go long.
I mean, it's no Colossal Dreadmaw, but it sounds like it's okay.
Hmm. 6 mana. Interesting. Well, because my card, 6 mana as well. I'm talking about Chandra Awakened Inferno.
Yes.
So this is a card I've been hype on for a super long time. And the more I play with it, the more I absolutely just love it.
Hold on, you actually have cast it.
Thanks to friend of the show, T, for once again giving me a copy at GP Denver.
Zach, good news. I cast it too.
Woo!
Round 1, GP Indy MCQ, paired against Eldrazi Tron. Game 2, I'm up a game. I've control of the board. I get to 6 mana. I cast Chandra. Opponent scoops on the spot.
There we go.
Card is gas. I don't need any more evidence.
Yeah, and honestly, a lot of my experience online is me playing it and opponent scooping to it just because of the inevitability it represents. And often, like I said, games can get really grindy. And this is the mirror breaker when it comes to that grindy game. Because when they are passing turns back, they are taking that damage. I've also had the fun experience of me casting this, my opponent tapping mana and trying to logic knot me, and then me clicking OK and them going, what happened? And I said, well, the spell can't be countered. And then me getting 30 sweet prize points.
It's one of 67 cards with that text.
Exactly. Well, 68, 61, which are playable in Modern.
All right, Zach, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How many Chandra Awakened Inferno emblems do you keep in your deck box?
Ooh, I just have one that I give to my opponent and I put a dice on to mark how many they have.
An emblem with dice on it.
So, which I know may not be correct under certain terms anymore. So I've been thinking about bringing jelly beans, cinnamon, or black licorice.
You get to choose.
Yeah.
Have a bots every flavor bean.
Stan is showing me 3 emblems right now. I think that's important that the nation know that.
Could be buttered popcorn, could be garbage.
My 3 Chandra emblems are sleeved up. I just want to get to the point where I'm giving my opponent an emblem every turn instead of using dice. I think by emblem number 3, my opponent is sick of me.
Right.
But I'll keep the charade up as long as I can.
That would just be so funny. I'm imagining like you peeling it out of the deck box again.
A good friend of mine, Kay, instead of an emblem, what they have done is crossed out the text on Curse of the Pierced Heart, aside from deals 1 damage to you at the beginning of your upkeep. And they go ahead and hand those to the opponent. So it's essentially the text of the card.
This is for you.
Yeah.
Kind opponent.
This is my altered card that will function as an emblem and is yours to keep for the duration of this match.
No, I'm glad it's working for you. I'm glad both of those cards are working for you. Mine is much more of a spiky card, spiky set of cards, but I think it kind of gets at our personalities a little bit.
Weird red cards versus time-tested spike cards? Is that the difference you're speaking of?
Johnny Jenny versus Timmy Tammy versus Spike.
And the wheel continues to go on.
Well, there you go, folks. That wraps up this week's show. Our favorite sideboard cards, our favorite sideboard strategies. We hope you don't have to get paired up against us anytime soon, because do we have a 15-card plan for you?
Hopefully.
Ideally.
Unless you're on Living End.
Oh, God. This will be on Living End.
In which case, we will scoop aggressively. If you haven't yet, Make sure you subscribe to our podcast so you get the latest episodes as soon as they come out. And if you use Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and review. If you'd like to submit a question to the podcast, pick our brain in something in modern, you might hear it appear as a wind down. You might even hear it appear as the entire episode. You can tweet us at thedivedown, all one word, or email thedivedown@gmail.com. If you'd like to support the show, you can join our Patreon. Joining at any tier gets you access to our super secret Slack channel, where you can spend your days looking busy at work while secretly chatting with fellow modern lovers from all over the world, including the hosts of the show. So find that at patreon.com/thedivedown. As always, special thanks to the bands Nowhere and Spaceblood for letting us use their music. And until next week, get out there and build your sideboard! And congratulations on winning SCG Denver, by the way.
I tried my best. No, that wasn't Denver. Where was it? Oh, Dallas. I wish it was in Denver. That'd be awesome.
Wait, you were in Dallas? You didn't tell us?
Which tournament did you win?
Stan, you know very well I haven't won any tournaments recently.
As if to imply.